Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Wherever you are in the world, welcome to the Gang Talks on Fifth Wrist Radio, and thanks for tuning in. And as we know, Fifth Wrist was set up by enthusiasts to serve the community by giving community members the opportunity to review their own watches. This way, you can actually be honest about what it's like to live with the watch and tell people about your pros and cons, what you like, what you don't like, etc. So if you haven't already, get over to the website, fifthwrist.com, and review one of your watches and help another community member make the right decision. So my name's Anthony, I'm from Defining Time, and I'm joined by some absolute legends tonight. So welcome to the show. First of all, we have Michael Woods and Vinny. How are you going, gents?
Good.
Good. How very good, Anthony? Thank you.
Yeah, awesome. Really, really good. Pumped for tonight's show. We've got some awesome stuff coming up, but I need to also introduce a special guest tonight to the show, someone who I've wanted to get onto the podcast for quite a while. So welcome to Desi, which is Desi101 on Instagram. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fantastic, and thanks for having me. So good to...
Our pleasure. We'll get to know Desi in a little bit and maybe talk about a couple of his watches that he's got. But tonight we've got a full-on show, and what I really wanted to do tonight was head out to the community and just ask some questions on topics that people wanted to hear about. So we've got some fantastic questions from our crew and our Slack group and people from Instagram to have a chat about. And yeah, we'll see where the night takes us. So we'll do some wrist checks and some drink checks, and then we'll hear a little bit from Desi, and then we'll get into the show. So who wants to kick us off? Why don't we start with Vinny? What is on your wrist and what are you drinking?
Alrighty, so tonight I've got the Undone Space Explorer on the wrist. It's just the quirkiest, funkiest space watch I think you can get for a few $100. Not to everyone's taste, the handset is quite extravagant, but I'm loving it. Too much fun for the money. And then I'm drinking, I've got gone after Roman and I've done the gin and tonic. So enjoying it on a Saturday night.
Nice. Can we just talk a little bit about this Undone watch? So, because it's really cool. It's so different. The hands are so unique. Kind of looks like the picture you put up recently looks like a duck or some sort of bird, like a sort of beak. Can you see that?
A beak? Yeah, maybe.
But tell us a little bit about it. So what made you buy this?
All right. So I think one of the guys linked it in the group chat. And I thought, that's too fucking cool. How often do we get to commemorate actual space events in our lifetime, not just throwbacks or re-editions? So this one commemorates the first private space flight and done by SpaceX. And yeah, so there are lots of design cues that are taken from the rocket itself, like the hour hand, the beak, as you would call it, comes from the chest plate of the spacesuit. The minute's hand is resemblant of the slingshot maneuver of the Apollo 13 craft when they had to go around the moon halfway and make their way back somehow. It's just so cool. It's not like anything else I have in the collection. It's just a quartz watch, but yeah, too much value.
What about the strap? What's the strap? Is there any like spacesuit or something?
I don't think so, but it's just
some sort of fabric.
Yeah, it's just like a Cordura strap, and it's white, so our mate Drew will love it.
Yes.
It gets filthy like after a couple of days, so I've actually swapped it out for something else. White is not easy to keep clean.
No. I don't know what's going on with him in that space, but that's fine.
He's got a monopoly on it. Every time anyone sees a white strap, they tag him, link him. He influenced the world, so he's famous.
Good old Drew. Shout out to Drews on Instagram. Good chat. Actually, just received one of his a watch that he'd been lusting for quite some time with the Grey Side of the Moon Omega. So congratulations to him. Cool, Michael. What is on the wrist? What are you drinking?
I've got the Zenith El Primero Manufacturer Edition again tonight. I swapped it out for the Bremont MB2 for a few days, but yeah, just had to come back to it. So yeah, got that on tonight. Loving it. And I've gone watch regulator style. I've made myself a White Russian tonight, a big pint of White Russian. So
very good.
It's going down well.
Love your work. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Very good. And Desi, our guest, what's on your wrist and what are you drinking?
Well, first of all, as I say, great to be here. I'm obviously the substitute for Alex. He's obviously done a hamstring during the week in training. You know, it's like
the token Scotsman.
We did a Scotsman. We know a Scotsman. Oh, we'll get this old guy in. He'll do at least do one match for us. So thanks for having me. And on my wrist tonight, I've got the Sapeneva Moomin watch.
Yes,
unbelievable.
Which I absolutely adore. So
love it.
Yeah,
very cool. And drinking? What are you drinking?
Well, in honor of Alex, I'm double part, not triple part, but I am the substitute. So I've got a Negroni. And then I've got a nice Yarra Valley Pinot Noir ready to rock and roll after the Negroni. So that's
cool.
Slotting right in. Fitting the bill.
And so let's just, I'd like to ask a few questions about the Sapeneva. So first of all, what made you buy it? And second of all, how's the overall sort of, I mean, we know expected from Sapeneva is going to be pretty good, but how's the overall build quality?
So why I bought it was, it actually takes me back to my childhood. So I watched a lot of Moomin sort of the cartoons when I was growing up, and it really resonates as something from my childhood. And in fact, when I saw it, launched, I rushed to my wife and said, I'm asking for permission, but I really, really want this. And I don't usually do that with watches. I usually just go and just execute and buy it. But I really was like, this is really, it's got a lot of powerful memories for me from my childhood. So that was the Moomin piece. And I've had some Sapeneva watches before, but, and then the quality is, well, the thing with these watches is the depth of the dial is incredible. Like, you know, even the previous one I owned, and you sort of, it's almost like a TARDIS, because you look at it from the, and you see the depth, and then you look from the side and it's got like, you know, an 8 or 9 mil profile. And then you turn it over and see the depth, and you turn it back across and say, hold on, how do they get so much depth onto the dial with such limited sort of, you know, depth of space? So it's pretty spectacular. And then the loom is just crazy. So, my girls run to it when they see it. They want to loom it up. So they kind of love seeing that piece as well. So it's pretty cool. And then the wearability, for me, I've got a sort of 6¾-inch wrist. So at 38.7, whatever it is, it's a perfect fit for me across the wrist as well. So wears really well, but the dial is just incredible.
Beautiful. Very cool. I really think it's such a unique watch that, you know, like it's like nothing we've ever really seen before, which I think is just super cool. So now we've got a mystery guest, everyone, and the boys don't know this gentleman is coming on. So before we introduce him, what I might do is do my quick wrist check and drinks check, and then we'll go over to our mystery guest. So isn't this exciting? You guys got no idea.
No idea.
I saw that pop and I'm like, who is this?
The suspense. All right, we'll just keep him in the green room for 1 second. So on my wrist tonight is my Habering TZ21 Deadbeat Seconds on this beautiful double croc strap, which was made by Grau and Martin Carswell there in Melbourne. I love this watch. It's such a cool piece. And yeah, I think, you know, it's a really, really integral part of my collection that I always sort of drive back to. And I have two of the most manliest drinks in the world. I know you guys can probably guess what they are, but we have one of Coca-Cola's finest zeros and Carlton Brewery Pure Blonde Ultra Low Carb Lager, 80% less carbohydrates than normal beer. So while everyone else is getting chunky, I am losing weight, so this is great. I get to drink beer and lose weight at the same time.
I could just picture you like wearing like a headband, like workout gear, and like pink like spandex pants or something like that. I don't know. That just popped into my head.
thank you very much.
You're on the treadmill right now talking to us.
Actually, Anthony,
that's how I walk my dog. Okay, Vinny.
So I was going to say, shout out to Martin Carswell. I reached out to him recently just for some advice and some help. And he's like a master leather worker. What he does is incredible. And he was more than happy to respond to my questions and help me out and give me time of day. So yeah, shout out to Martin.
Very cool.
Nice guy.
Yeah, I've got some plans to, I want to get a couple of things done for a few different watches. So I'll be reaching out to him shortly. So now, speaking of chunky, welcome to the show, Dimmy, the chunky wrist. How are you today?
Good evening, gentlemen.
Ah, oh, there he is.
I feel privileged in amongst illustrious company.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're here, Dimmy, because I've got a bone to pick with you.
What have I done?
Just come on the show.
Judge Judy,
exactly. Straight into it.
What happened? What have I done?
Oh, Vinny Strap Awards, and you voted for the Vacheron. The Sharpen Ava Moon was there. I'm like, what is going on here? My best mate, Dimmy. My ex-best mate, Dimmy, is voting for the Vacheron. So Anthony, thank you for inviting the chunky rest.
Pleasure. My pleasure. So, Dimmy, why don't we quickly go to you and just get a quick drinks check and wrist check. So what are you drinking what's on your wrist?
I've been on a mission last few weeks and buying up a whole heap of boutique gins out of across Australia wide. So tonight I've started with a Negroni, actually. So I've gone with a Navy Strength gin from Applewood out of SA. That tonight. So quite potent, about 60% alcohol for that gin. So
making up for Anthony's weak effort. Nice.
Yeah,
shout out to SA.
Coke Zero.
And what's on the wrist?
So today the sun was shining, so I decided to put on the Oris Diver 65, the Momotaro edition with the pastel green dial. So I've got that on the cheapest Nodo single pass strap, like a black one. So I've been rocking that all day today. Really enjoying this piece. So one of those days where bright colors was the norm, and really enjoyed it.
Very good. Very good. How have you found the strap on that watch, the sort of denim?
It's a bit, on a cold day for me, it works out well. I can probably go two holes in. But as the weather gets warmer, I just pulled it off. So I originally had a couple of other 65s in the past. Remember the original dial with the 12, 3, 6, 9 digits? So I had a canvas strap for that, which I kept, and I put that on at the start. So that's quite long, it's plenty big enough. But on the NATO straps now, I'm converted, Ant, due to you. I haven't been a fan of NATOs in the past. I've chucked them on NATOs, many straps or many watches lately, and I haven't looked back. I actually ordered some of those original Bond straps, which you guys have seen on my Instagram, and I can't go back. And the way the weather is at the moment, putting them on is fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. Did anyone see that Aquanaut that someone put on a white NATO strap the other day?
Yeah.
On a white strap.
Oh, dear.
How good was that?
That wasn't Drew, was it?
No, it wasn't Drew, but I'm sure he would have loved it. Cool. Gosh. All right, well, let's get into the show. Thank you to the gents, Dimmy and Desi, for joining us tonight. And I think, going to have some fun. So we've met Dimmy before in a podcast back. I think it was about episode 7 or 8 that we met Dimmy on the show. So let's go to Desi and just tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your collection, and then we'll get into the questions from the community. So over to you.
So I'm based in Melbourne as well. So we're in the naughty corner in Australia. So we went from the most livable city in the world to the lepers of Australia. So, but I've been in Australia, I can tell by the accent, 20 plus years. First landed in Brisbane. Had a stint in Sydney, then most of my time has been down here in Melbourne. From a watch perspective, I think we all get into my journey is kind of similar to a lot of people. My father was insanely crazy about watches, and he's got a couple of drawers, I think, full of watches. And even holidays, we spent half a day doing watch shopping. Go holiday to Spain, and we spent half a day in the bazaars of wherever we were looking at watches. My first sort of watch was decent was the G-Shock, which I bought in 1997, whatever it was. And I got back, I bought that the weekend, went into work, and all my work colleagues absolutely laughed at me about wearing this plastic clock on my wrist, because no one wore 40-something plus millimeter watches in those days. And about 2002, I decided I'm going to buy one good watch, and I'm not going to follow my father's footsteps. So I bought Omega Speedmaster Reduced, and that was going to be it. And lo and behold, the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. So 8 years ago, I got really into watches again and started really with a lot of vintage. So like the Vulcan Cricket watch, I bought one of them, old Grand Seikos, old Datejusts. And then so I went more modern, but again, sort of a mixture between Rolex and sort of independence, like Nomos, Metro, etc. So I kind of went through that sort of phase through my sort of watch collection. And then I get sucked in a bit deeper and a bit deeper. So you kind of then up the ante on your drug hit. So like the A. Langazona 1815, AP, Royal Oak, that was a 37 mil, and kind of then went that way and started thinking it was pretty good, but not being fully informed. And then really had a real change about. So if I look at my collection now, very, very independent, heavy. So the Harbring, I've got a SUF 180, which I just purchased, the Sapeneva, Ocean Junior. I had a Ocean Junior before, so I had a mixture before, I had the Perpetual. Which was pretty big for me. It's a 42 mil. I'm usually under 40 mil kind of watches. But I loved that watch, but it was just, and I persevered with it because I loved it. And I loved the sort of philosophy with Ludwig Oschelin and simplicity of it. Yeah, it's a perpetual calendar. So I've now got the annual, which is a 39 mil, which suits me. It's a much better fit for my wrist. And it's still, you know, a complicated watch with minimum sort of fuss. And then some other, so I really went independent, the Corona watch as well, the Green Dial as well. So yeah, so very varied, but very independent heavy would be where I sort of went to. And the reason for that is really just the passion. You know, Rolex make a good watch, Omega make a good watch. But, you know, and the people who work in those organisations all work hard, but the independence is a passion. They're driving something different. And if you're a passionate watch collector, I think you want to then support someone who just really has that passion for the watches. So that's kind of what's driven me to this. And then you get the variety from an independent watchmaker.
And I think, so for you, that's probably the course you're going to stay on, I'm guessing. It's pretty hard to go back out once you're getting deep into independent.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I had an issue, like with you, I had an issue with my Harbring as well.
Yeah.
Small issue, and actually Oliver in Adelaide, so really helped fix that. But again, just the quickly jumping on the problem, it was a tiny problem, but and getting that resolved, and you know, and the Oliver and it was actually Maria who kind of helped with that, so like make sure it get resolved quickly. You don't typically get that. Well, that really, really. Intimate and caring, and really want to make sure you have a good experience. It's hard to beat. So,
definitely,
yeah.
Cool. Well, it's an awesome journey. It sounds like you had the Speedy Reduced for probably what?
Oh, I've had that
6 or 7 years, but as itself, like, yes, it's just sort of as your only watch before you went completely.
Correct. Well, I said I'm not going to make the same mistake as your father. I kind of almost have that and say I'm going to buy one watch and that's it. That's I'm not going to have drawers of watches. And yeah. Here I am hiding and squirreling away watches so that my wife doesn't see. So, and hopefully she doesn't listen to the podcast. Oh, I had an experience where I had to really come clean with my...
This is the best story
ever. Please tell. This one's so amazing. You can't say that and then not tell. Go on.
Oh, well, this is where I went to I took my daughter to a specialist. She was having some stomach problems. So,
yes.
And I was wearing like a daggy pair of jeans and a grey sweatshirt. But I wore the 1815. And we're through the consultation and, you know, spending it, obviously, it's top consultants that were spending quite a bit of money, you know, per minute almost during this consult. And he kept looking at my wrist. And I'm sort of getting a bit sort of conscious. So I'm kind of like trying to hide under this little dodgy sweater that I've got on. And then during the, he almost just stops and he says, "Excuse me, is that a Elanazon?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And I thought, I'm busted.
Shit.
Because my wife's going to me, what's happening?
So this was a genuine fake out of Thailand.
And he's like, "Oh, your husband, he's got a really serious watch on his wrist." And my wife's thinking, well, if this top specialist is saying, "Wow, what the hell is this?" So, and I mean, my daughter started looking, going, "What the heck is going on?" So he says, "What else you got?" And I'm like, "Oh, well, I've got a Grand Seiko. I've got it." Anyway, so he wants them a whole collection. And of course, it became a very painful process for me during this whole thing. So I'm like, "Oh," so anyway, we're talking away. And then, of course, we leave the consultation, we pay, and then we get into the car park. And then, of course, we're driving. My wife's like, "What the heck is that on your wrist? Like, what?" And I'm like, "No, it's nothing. It's just a watch." And she's like, "Bullshit."
Oh, that is awesome. That is, if you're ever going to get busted, that's the way you want to get busted.
That's so annoying, though, because you get the lunger because it's understated. The party's at the back. You're wearing like a sweater and jeans. And that's exactly how I'd rock a high horology piece as well, like just casual. And you've just got done. I mean, oh, you'd expect that with a yellow gold day date, but not a white gold 1815.
Yeah. So anyway, got busted. So anyway, that was, so I've had to come clean on
rehab.
The rest of my watches. So.
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, there's a little bit of a taste of day in the life of Desi. But anyway, thank you very much for that. And let's get into some of the questions now. So good friend of the show and part of our Slack group and Instagram community here in Australia and in Melbourne is Denny, who's known for his Soviet kind of pieces from Russian and all sorts of different sort of Eastern European watchmakers. He's got a fantastic and fascinating collection. So he's KGB on time on Instagram. And he's asked, does in-house mean anything anymore? So maybe we start with the watchmaker of us, and then we'll go around the grounds and just get your opinions and see what people think. So, Woodsy, over to you. What do you think?
I was hoping you wouldn't.
Oh, dear.
No, that's okay. No, it's okay. I think, I thought about this, and I thought, it's sort of thrown around a lot these days. But I think it still has a lot of value if it's honest, you know. I mean, because making in-house is being like, there's a certain amount of independence there. So whatever is done in-house, you know, at least they're taking ownership or control of that process or whatever. If it's, you know, even if it's part of the watch, the dial or something like that. So I think it still does mean something, and I'm not sure if this is the answer that, you know, we're looking for, or the way that we want to answer it is correct. But to me, even when you look at bigger brands that are independent, I think that still means something because they've invested a certain amount of money and they've taken ownership of certain elements of the watch. Because it would be very easy to just, you know, get things brought in and, you know, assemble a watch and have other people make the stuff. So I think it does mean, you know, has value. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. What about everyone else?
I think there's so many extra questions that need to be asked in this. So I think what I might do is ask a few of these because it may help people sort of formulate their answers as well. But I think what specifies in-house these days, and there's a few little aspects of this, and how much can watch brands get away with claiming in-house when really in-house might mean that, you know, they designed the watch parts, then get them manufactured somewhere else and then bring them in, finish and put them together, and then that's in-house. Or I think I think 70% of the parts need to be made in Switzerland for it to be Swiss made on the dial and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's interesting. What do you think, Vinny?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I don't know where you can actually draw the line at the point of saying that's in-house or that's not. I think transparency is the key. You just got to be, if I see in-house movement, whatever reference they want to give it from the brand, and it's actually just a Salida or an ETA, like, ah, who cares? Just call it the ETA. There's no shame in that. I think it depends on the watch as well. Just be transparent. And if I'm looking at a really good value watch that has an ETA, I'm thinking, sweet, great, because I don't want to have issues down the line, servicing or whatever. It's like, okay, that's fine. But then if I'm going high horology and I want something that's very unique and got a really nice complication that's made in-house, then that's really got value in terms of horology itself. So, yeah, it just depends on the watch and how transparent the brand is, because if they just slap a custom rotor on it and it's still got the hallmarks of a stock standard movement that you can buy off a shelf, then I'm not interested in that. But, yeah,
so time and place for everything. Is that the issue then, Vinny, when companies like the Bella Rosses and the Orises put a custom rotor on then rename their movement outside of a, based on a Salet or based on an ETA? But I think Tag Heuer must be one of those prevalent examples where they just rename everything to give that perception that what they've put in there is not an actual in-house movement or for some of the lower end pieces.
Yeah, so that's exactly like what us, I mean.
For example, we may understand that because as our collection evolves, we probably start off with the basics and sort of move up to the mid-range and then all to the high horologies of the VCs and the Pateks or the Rolexes. So we have an understanding of what to look out for. But people, if they're brand conscious and they want a brand, they won't know anything better than, they won't care what the movement is in there until they come to the point where, you know, well, I've got to service it. Then all of a sudden it goes $1,000 or $15,000 or $2,000 depending on the piece.
Yep.
Did anyone see the bill for that O Lang and Zona on Instagram the other day? Like fucking $8,000 US or something.
Yeah. Jesus. It was a bit beat up, let's be truthful.
Yeah.
It had a challenging childhood, that watch.
No, it's a good point, Jimmy. And what about you, Dizzy? What do you think?
I think we're all sort of struggling with it. It depends. And I suppose it's like, why? I mean, if someone's got a movement, where, I suppose my view is, where's the creativity going to be from that brand? Is it, if they're saying it's the movement, it's the creativity, then just sort of rebrashing, you know, redoing an ETA and putting a different rotor on it, well, that's not really creativity. But if the creativity of that brand is dial or, you know, the design element of the watch, it's easy to use, and it therefore makes sense to use a standard movement, because that's not where the creativity of that brand is. Whereas if a brand is saying, oh, we're creative on the movement side because we're doing all these crazy complications, then you know, obviously in-house is super important then, because that's where the creativity and innovation is going to be, is in that complication piece. So I think it depends for me where the brand's creativity is coming from, and that's where they should be claiming, you know, that's why it's a hard one to say it depends, because that's where you're really looking at, where's the value of that brand, where's the creativity? And it doesn't have to be the movement that creates that value and creativity piece. But if they are relying on that as a selling, or that's where they say, we've got all this innovation and value is in the movement, and it's just a base movement, that's where the deception is.
Do you guys put in emphasis when you're acquiring the next piece? Do you actually look at the movement? Is that important? Do you actually think about future servicing costs?
I'll jump in. It depends on the watch, but mostly I want peace of mind. So the watches that I go for at the moment tend to be sporty, and the watches I'm going to go for are going to be dressy. But the common denominator is I don't want to forking out an arm and a leg to service a watch, or for it to take 6 months before a watchmaker looks at it, if something was to go wrong or later on down the line. Because the whole point of these things is that they'll last. They'll you know, outlive me. And so I don't want to be at the mercy of a off-brand, unique, shortcutted, in-house movement. I just want peace of mind, and I want to know that what's in my watch is going to work, and a master watchmaker like Mr. Woods can fix her up, no worries.
Well, I'm fortunate that I don't consider that, because I never consider the service aspect. Well, actually, I do. No, I do. I do a little bit, because I know how difficult certain watches are to service. So, for me, when I'm buying a watch, I think, all right, how much time am I going to spend when it comes to servicing it? But generally, I don't have to think about it because I'll just work on it myself. So if I was to buy any Rolex, then I just know this is easy. That'll be just a day of listening to a podcast, and I don't have to worry about it. But if it's something else, then I might have to source parts or really think about what I'm doing. But yeah, I don't have to be concerned really. So
yeah, I think the key for me, Timmy, is as I'm getting more and more into collecting. I think I said this on a podcast a little while ago. I don't want to end up with, say, you know, I don't want to have a stupid amount of watches. I think somewhere between 8 and 12 is probably where I want to sit. And even that to me just seems a bit ridiculous because I can't wear them all at the same time. But I don't want to end up with, and I went through the in-house snobbery thing a couple of years ago. And I'm so glad that I got over that really quite quickly, actually. But I don't want to end up with a collection of, say, let's say I've got 8 watches or 10 watches and they're all in-house movements and they all need to be sent back to either service centers for months or back to Switzerland to get fixed or serviced or whatever. Because I don't want to spend $1,000 on each watch or more every, 3 to 5 years. I'd rather, and that's why I've got my Oxen Junior and my Stover and things like that, that I know that I can give them to friends of the show that can service them for me for, a really good price, and off we go again. So I think that I don't want to end up with, I'm happy to have a couple, but I don't want to end up with a stupid amount of in-house movements because I don't want to spend the money servicing them in years to come.
Yeah. I think this is also a point where, and it's something that Roger Smith talks about as well, is that he talks about the luxury should actually be the ability to have 10 plus years of before serviceability. That's actually luxury. It's something that's built to last, and there's quality in the movement, and there's quality that we can actually build something. And he talks about obviously watches that are 30, 40 years old, 50, and then they've been serviced, yet they work perfectly well and the oil's gone. So there really is I think that quality in terms of movement, design, and period between servicing. If you look at cars, that service interval has increased, but yet watches, that service interval hasn't really increased, which is the question mark that people have around why should they go and buy a very expensive watch and then spend $8,000 on a service. And it's almost like the car industry 15, 20 years ago.
Well, I think it is shifting though in some aspects, Desi, because you look at things like JLC now have their, it's 8 or 7, I think it's 8 year warranty. Yeah. So they're now claiming that the oils and lubricants and things that they're using, and you've got ceramic rotor bearings for automatic rotors and things like that, that are starting to shift the way that these in-house movements are built so that they can get some longevity in their services. And I think it's fantastic that JLC have done that. And I think, Kia did it in the car space a number of years ago, and other manufacturers are starting to follow that. And I'm really happy for the consumer point of view that brands are now really thinking about this kind of thing that Roger Smith's saying, that these things should go a fair while without needing to be touched. As long as they're treated well and they're respected and you're not just, treating them like crap all the time, then they should last a fair while. So
I think you're right. I think even I remember Rolex saying that they want to shift their service intervals out to 10 years, even if the guarantee period isn't that long. I think the Skydweller was the first one that they said, all right, this shouldn't need servicing for 10 years. So they're starting to think that way. And, talking about in-house, I'm sort of understanding a little bit more about the question. And there's not that many actual fully in-house producers out there, even the bigger brands that claim in-house. Like when you talk about Roger Smith, he's one of the only ones that's fully in-house. Some of the big brands that claim to be in-house, they haven't manufactured the movement from the start. They may have finished the movement, but so it's really difficult to draw the line, as Vinny said. Like it's hard to say. Yeah, fully in-house, you've got to go to someone like Roger Smith or Kari Virtanen or Rolex or
And I think, Michael, you've hit the nail on the head. So if I read this question again, does in-house mean anything anymore? And I think what sort of Den is trying to discuss here is, without being here, so good on you, Den, you've done well, where do we draw the line of, you know, someone says if a brand comes out and claims an in-house movement. Now, I have a Tag 1887 that was one of, you know, was marketed as a Tag in-house movement, yet they bought the rights from Seiko, from a previous caliber that Seiko were no longer going to use anymore. So to the people that are not really as deep as others that hear this in-house thing and believe it, like I believed it, I absolutely believed it, and I thought it was amazing. And then I knew, and then I found this out. And so I think that the point of the question is probably more so the fact that what does in-house mean anymore? And are there only really a select few, like even Moser, for example, you know, they produce their own hairsprings. They supply 25, you know, some big, very big brands in the industry that don't disclose that they're supplied by the Moser sister company. So yeah, it's interesting, and it's going to be interesting to see where it goes with the transparency opening up.
I mean, it's interesting. Like you can sort of give people, you can appreciate the people or companies that do it, but I don't think it means that much anymore. Like really, I think quality, as long as it's quality, that means more than, like, to claim completely in house. Yeah, I don't think, yeah, it doesn't have as much value anymore, because you could make something completely yourself, but then the quality could be crap too. So I think as long as the quality is good and you've had some input in it, you know, I think that's the most important thing. I think the thing, people want to go out, buy a good product. It doesn't necessarily have to be completely in-house. It just has to be a good, reliable product. So
yeah, I only think there's two, or besides from the independents, if you take them aside, I think Seiko and Rolex are the only two real in-house manufacturers that you should really respect and pay attention to for their in-house manufacturing.
Probably JLC as well.
Yes, true. Yep, that's right. Because they, JLC have actually supplied some of the biggest brands. I mean, for years it was like there were JLC movements in Patek and AP and yeah.
Definitely, so, definitely.
Yeah. And vice versa.
Interesting. You
know? Yeah.
Interesting topic. And I think the good thing, I suppose, is, especially from a community perspective, is the fact that there's, for some reason, there's becoming a lot more transparency and brands are getting somewhat caught out. And I think it's just going to promote honesty from brands if they're going to want to keep the loyal customer base. Because once people find out there's lies out there and that things aren't exactly what they seem, then that can't end well if they don't own it.
No, if you lose the trust, like, you know, and it could be one little blemish, but that just dissolves the brand's trust, you know, in the community. You know, what else have they been lying with? What else have they been not quite so transparent with? So I think you are seeing more and more of that. And you see with everything, not just watches, but every industry, you're seeing that, you know, full process being transparent to the end consumer, because we're all being much more knowledgeable, whether it's food or cars or, you know, watches. We want to know that full end to end to make sure that we're buying something ethical and good.
Yeah, and I suppose cars do it as well, especially under those big kind of Richemont-esque type dealers like VAG with Volkswagen, that, you know, the Skoda has that 132 TSI, TFSI movement has been in the Skoda, it's been in the Golf, it's been in the Audi A3. And they sort of all just share these DSG gearboxes, these drivetrains and engines, yet one's 40,000, one's 60,000, and one's 80,000, and they're all owned by the same people. So I think we're going to see potentially a lot more of that in the watch industry, especially as we see ETA start to shake up things a little bit as well, which it's going to be interesting. All right, great question, Den. That certainly got the conversation going. So Benoit, friend of the show, co-host on another podcast now, which will be dropping shortly, called the
Vintage Hen House.
Vintage Hen House, yes.
And Benoit, the cocktail connoisseur as well. Okay, don't forget that part as well.
And with the cracker headgear as well. What a legend. So he wants to know, what watch do you want for Christmas? So why don't we start with Desi, and then we'll go to Dimmy, and then the rest of us can catch up. So Desi, what do you want for Christmas?
Well, obviously, Santa Claus is paying for this watch. It's not coming out of my bank balance or anyone else I know. For me, it'll probably be Roger Smith Series 5 Open Dial 38mm Platinum. Thank you very much, Santa.
Mic drop.
I'll take that every day of the week. And nice. I'll see you again next year, Santa.
You can come back anytime.
There'll be carrots, biscuits, and a little shot of whiskey for Rudolph every year.
That's not asking for much.
Yeah, that's a great choice too. That's a great choice. Like those open dials where you get to see the finishing under on that dial side is beautiful.
Yeah. It makes it look, obviously it's modern. It's like a modern, obviously that look of open dial makes it modern. Yeah, it's a very traditional watch and very traditional. So you get that sort of best of both worlds. Around that piece, but that's all Santa for this year.
Do you want box and papers as well?
Look, I'll take it without. I'll ask Mr. or Dr. Roger Smith if he can kind of sign something for me just to prove it's authentic.
And business class flights to the Isle of Man to pick it up.
Yeah,
sweet.
You can take that one to the doctor's, Des. I reckon you'll be fine.
Specialist won't know. I won't get rumbled on that one.
Funny. All right, Dimmy, what about you? What do you want for Christmas?
Oh, just probably something that you guys probably wouldn't expect, but I think last few weeks, listening to all these other podcasts as well, I've come across, I'm sure you guys have heard of a brand called Fears out of the UK. I'm a big fan of that Brunswick, the white dial. So I'm not asking for much, Santa, but you know what? I think that's probably achievable. Especially that's something two or three times the price, but I keep jumping on their website. I keep hesitating for an order, but I think one day I'm going to just pull that trigger because that white dial, the salmon looks great. I just think that white just speaks. Every time I look at it, I just want it more. So I think that'll be probably the next one that I'll probably, hopefully Santa gives me for this Christmas. I think we'll just go forward for next year from there.
I think you got a better chance than Desi anyway.
Well, he's going to stop off there first. He's going to stop off at Demi's first and then drop obviously mine off. He's going to keep the top package for last.
He's going to be wearing it, enjoying it for as long as possible.
That simplicity of that watch. It just grows every time I see it. I just love it. I just love it.
Yep.
Good. Very good. Michael, what about you? What's for Christmas?
I'm not looking at a grail at the moment, but I was thinking something like a Tank Cartier Tank Cintre or a 8-second Remitoire from the Groenfeld brothers, something like that. I mean, they're a stretch. It's not something as Desi said, it'd be something that, you know, Santa would be paying for, but the Cartier that was really on my mind, and I was so close to pulling the trigger on the platinum one if I had the chance. But
I love the Cartier.
It's unbelievable when you actually put it on the wrist too. The fit is just it's beautiful. So they'd be just my two.
Yeah. A quick one on Cartier, because I think one of the things I discovered during the week this week, because I really like the Santos Dumont.
Mm-hmm.
So Dimmy's got one, but I think for me they're
not
the
a
one
Dumont.
That Dimmy's not a Dumont, got. Anthony. Oh, not the Dumont. That's just the Santos. Yeah, the 100. Is that right?
No. Just a large standard Santos.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so not that one, but they make the Santos Dumont now in the extra large size with the hand wound movement. That's the Caliber MC4. 430, I think it is, which is a hand wound movement based off the Piaget from a number of years ago.
Yeah, beautiful.
And they're like $8,000 Aussie, and I'm sure even better on the secondary market.
Yep.
I am all over that because that's just such a very cool watch, and to be hand wound as well.
Yep.
That's
very, great value. Very nice. That's really good value. Those movements are very fine and finished off beautifully. High quality. That's amazing value for that money.
So I'm trying to convince the wife to get one of those so that I can wear it when I need it.
Did you say $8,000?
$8,800 brand new from Cartier.
That is unreal. Yeah, that's pretty
good. No limited edition. And you know what? It's the same movement and case shape as that platinum, those limited editions that came out with the pictures of the airplanes on the back from the early 1900s or whatever they were.
Yep.
Same movement, same case, except it's stainless steel with a silver sunburst dial and blue sword hands as opposed to platinum with the, you know, beautiful creamy dial and the Breguet hands. But the platinum one's 60 grand, the steel one's 8 grand.
That's, that's unreal.
It's unbelievable value. Yep. So I can see that moving into the collection at some stage over the next year or so.
Yeah, that's where it's hard to justify getting platinum or precious metal. Like the platinum Centre is like over 30 retail if you can get it, and the secondhand market is like 40. So that's where it's like, yeah, that's so easy to buy steel, you know, compared to platinum, so or white gold.
Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Yep.
Cool. What do we got, Vinny?
Is Santa bringing you that watch, Anthony? That's the one.
No. That's not a Santa one. I'll get that one myself one day. I'll have to save my pennies.
Lovely. Look forward to that. No, it's a great watch. For me, this Christmas and the Christmas after that, and the Christmas is following, put together, I'm going for the VC. And you just slagged on platinum a bit, Michael, but yeah, I'm going for platinum. I think there's something about it. There's just X factor about platinum. Yes, I know it's not a financially wise decision, but watches aren't really financially wise decisions in general. But I just think with the grey dial and the precious metal, just god damn it, love that thing. So Santa, drop it by. You got my address, you got my number. Be happy for you to tee it up. I don't really care, box, papers, whatever. Drop it down the chimney. I'll be there to catch it.
Very good. Very good.
What about the servicing costs, Vinny?
Sorry?
The servicing costs.
So the 4400 series movement in that VC is actually a very traditional, straightforward movement which can be serviced pretty easily, I hear, from watchmakers.
It's just a manual. It's just a manual wind.
Manual wind, 65 hours of power reserve. Nothing too fancy. Just got a fat barrel in there and Bob's your uncle.
Yeah. Yep.
Beautiful. And I'm going to go completely left field here and I'm going to... Because it's coming from Santa, I'm going to say a Richard Mille RM16 Extra Flat.
Wow.
Because they are so fucking cool, to be honest. and I'm never going to get one, but if we're talking hopes and dreams here, I would love an RM16 because I just think they're just such a unique looking watch, something like 7 or 8 mil thick. Really beautiful crown and just skeletonized movement, all the shock protection you need, and just a sick watch. And I've been enjoying watching the US dollar inflate, and I'm like, oh, this one's 60 grand, oh, now it's 70, or now it's 60. but it's not gonna ever happen, but we'll see.
That is cool.
All right, cool. Let's go to so that's Benoit. We've got Rob from Hard on My Wrist. Sorry, he's a new guy to the community, sort of come in and really getting involved. So thank you for that, Rob. It's been great to sort of get to know you and your collecting journey. I know you're early in the piece, but his question is around what will get togethers look like now, and what do Fifth Wrist members want to see. And the pros and cons around AD sort of events and things like that in the future post sort of COVID and lockdowns. Interesting question. So why don't we go to Vinny first? We'll put him on the spot. What do you want to see and what do you think's going to happen?
Alrighty. So I've only really got an answer for this because of COVID. So when we did a few brand Zoom events and it was kind of a bit boring, a bit dull. So I realized that watch events by watch brands need to have watches there. And whether it's a new release, yes, have the new release pieces, but sneak in something exciting that enthusiasts and collectors would be like, shit, I would never see that unless it was this brand that could get this piece from another area of the world, or they got something from HQ and say, guys, we're serious about our boutique or our brand. We want to, reward you and say, look, here's something really special that you wouldn't otherwise see, and I guess in the perfect world, you'd be in the boutique and going hands-on with it, take a photo, you know, go, holy shit. And then, yeah, just get the watches out. I don't want to see press releases. I don't want to see magazines. I want to see the actual thing in the metal. So, yeah, that's my answer, I guess. It's all about the watches in the end for me.
Yeah, cool, good. Dimmy, what about you?
I think how many of us go to boutique events to sit there and look at the watches in the first place? I think we sort of get there to see all the boys and get together and have a chat. And I think we sort of have an idea of what brands have these days. And so we sort of get together just to sit there and mingle and sort of catch up. I guess moving forward, it's going to be completely different. I think we're all a hands-on kind of people. And, you know, every time we get together, there's always a new piece or maybe 5 or 10 when it comes to the group. You know, the group, you know, sort of swells to 20, 30, 40 people and we get together. And for us to sit there and be, I think, separated is going to be difficult, but I think we're going to have to adjust moving forward because the way things were is not how things are going to be moving forward because we're all going to be, it's going to be apprehensive, you know, because we're getting fed information and we're all going to start second guessing all these events, all these boutique openings or these new releases. And, you know, we're not people to sit there and be separated. You know, we always like to mingle and be close. So that's going to be, it's going to take a bit of adjusting to do that. But I mean, every time I get to an event or to see a get together, it's always to see the boys first and sort of being alienated or separated from the closeness, I guess, with all of us. It's going to take a fair bit of used to and adjusting as well moving forward.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And so one of the things you mentioned there about, you know, going to the events and looking at the watches, I did want to ask just on top of this, there was, I think Time and Tide did it, and I've seen lately that JLC, what are we all thinking about these packs that are getting sent out and how is that making people feel as part of the brands and the community? I certainly didn't get one, but, you know.
Well, neither did
it's
I.
Just because I live in Adelaide. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't get one, but I didn't sign up for one either. So
What was the pack? Describe what you're talking about.
Well, I think, Vinny, did you get one from JLC?
Yes, so what was in the bag was a can of Negroni, which was cool, from Four Pillars.
Yep.
And it was the latest catalogue for, I think, 1920. And then a cleaning cloth and a pen. So, yeah, like it was, I like the magazines because they have really good illustrations and this particular magazine had like amazing close-ups of the movements and stuff. So I enjoyed that. Negroni, nice as always. Won't say no to a drink. It's just nice than clicking a link and
well, if I can presented. Add,
but so, it's, yeah, go Dim.
So I was just going to say, I mean, the past few months have been online get-togethers, online boutique releases from like the Orises, the Grand Seikos and the Seikos or whoever it's been. They're just not the same as sort of going to an event or going to a get-together and having a meal.
Agreed.
And seeing people on Zoom is great. Whether we have to continue with the digital medium moving forward for the next 3, 4, 6, 12 months, we don't know. But nothing beats a sort of human interaction. Doing it online just doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're doing the best they can. Yeah.
They are for sure. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, there's nothing like going around with the boys and the gals. And just catching up and having the watches there.
It is, you know, it's just the whole, the anticipation, for example, on a Monday night, you know, we have a get-together book, for example, the Railway Hotel in Port Melbourne. So you leave work, you know, you change and you head in and you see the boys and you have a bite to eat, you have a beer, you talk watches, you take photos and you're done for the night. That's a great night.
I think, actually the brands can do a lot better on the virtual piece, Vinny. Like, you know,
I couldn't agree more.
What can they do? they come up and just give you a whole here, you know, it's like some sort of monodrone sort of, and you see everyone after about 5 minutes, see everyone zoom and they're either video off or they're like looking at their phone.
Yeah.
And I think the brands, because it's usually the big brands that are doing this piece of work, you know, it's not the smaller independents, it's usually the bigger. And they need to sort of say if they're doing a launch, because it's virtual, you can get anyone from anywhere onto these things, even recorded, doesn't matter. And it'd be a great opportunity for the brands to say, here was the designer, here was the person at the movement, here, what was your thought process behind that? Why and get them to explain how they developed the new watch and what was exciting for them and the process and what was the process they went through to kind of get, and they can do that because it's not like you're trying to fly someone to Melbourne, Adelaide, Sydney. That's impossible. But in the virtual world, it's actually easy to get us as consumers connected right back to the brand and the individuals who are designing that. And that way you get a story about why they built this, what was the reason why they wanted, what was the design elements they put in that resonated, and what was it the decision process. That would be a much more interesting insight into that launch than it's now got a blue dial or it's now got yellow or it's now, you know, we've picked pastel colors this year. Like, who cares? But it's a story, and it's really the big brands have missed that opportunity to connect their buyers with the actual people back in the factory and knowing wherever they are, the design studio, because this is actually the bit where people are at home and are used to now virtual events. You know, we do it at work, we do it, you know, for pleasure with family, and I'm zooming my family back home. So people are used to this medium and they've missed that opportunity as far as I can see.
I think there's been some good ones and that have made the most of what the situation is. And then, yeah, there's other brands that have missed the mark. And, yeah, after 5 minutes, you're looking at your phone going, oh, I'm on video. I wish I could log off, but I'll log off.
I think the Gerard Perregaux one was probably similar to what Desi's saying there, where they had quite a few people talking about the designing of the case and the way that it all works and the way that it's put together. And I know that it was a pretty sort of monologued conversation, but at least they were talking about interesting things and they had different people talking at different times.
Yep.
So
you can pre-record it. You know, the thing with the brands is, you know, I realize it's 2 a.m. in Switzerland.
Yeah.
But they can record something to say, in this launch, let's do this piece of work and actually build some collateral. Then when we launch this, we can do these mini events. You know, that's what these agencies market. You know, they spend a lot of money in marketing and a lot of clever marketing people. That's how they need to engage with their consumers, their end users, and start putting some intelligence around it and get engagement.
Yeah, so, and I suppose we'll all be wearing gloves at get-togethers next, I suppose, especially at AD events, because if we're handing around watches, I hope that's the case and they don't just keep watches behind a glass cabinet for safety reasons, at least hand out some gloves that you get to keep and hand them around. It's going to be interesting to see where it all goes.
Yep.
Sorry, Vinny?
Nope, that wasn't me.
Oh, it's me. Oh, wasn't you? It was me. Even the face. I mean, I think even the face-to-face, just what Demi said, you turn up and you're not really there for the launch of the watch. You're actually there for the community.
Yeah.
And that, again, is a missed opportunity by that brand, where if they had doing something a bit more innovative and experience and even some sort of story or narrative they tell why they're launching this and what's the reason, and then they engage the community, and then the discussion afterwards isn't about other things you've met as you're the community. You're actually discussing the topic of the brand who have just actually talked about the launch. So they miss that opportunity as well at these, even the face-to-face events.
Yeah. Cool. All right. We'll keep going. We've got another one from Den, KGB on time. So what is the most underappreciated field of horology? Interesting question, because I think it could be taken many different ways, but what do we think is the most underappreciated field of horology? Jeez. Who wants a crack?
Dimi, I reckon. Question. I reckon Dimi.
Oh God. I haven't thought about this question, to be honest. Look, a lot of, I don't know if it's a field, but an aspect that I think is important, I guess, for me, he's got sort of a larger wrist. I think fit and feel and finish, sort of case design and I guess angles and slopes of lugs is pretty important if you get that right. Even for smaller wrists, probably more so, just the way it extends over, maybe bending around the wrist and around to sort of the clasp or the bracelet or the strap to make it fit properly. I think if that's not done properly, I think a watch that you've been chasing for a while ends up being a piece of crap if it doesn't fit properly. And I guess these days too, we can't get into boutiques. You know, we sort of take a punt and buy online, and if we don't get it right, and then we sort of lose interest and we lose any appreciation for a brand altogether. So I think the engineering when it comes to horology, I think is huge to make sure that the case fits properly on everyone's wrist. Larger wrist for me, maybe not so much, but I think the smaller wrist is pretty important as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. What about you, Woodsy?
Yeah, I actually sort of agree with Dimmy a little bit there, because you can look at a watch online and see that it's, you know, there's a certain beauty to it, but if a case is designed really nicely, it'll feel nice, and there's something to it. And you know, when you put a watch on and you tend to put watches on more in the end that just feel better on your wrist too. And it's a hard one to get right, to have something wrap around your wrist correctly. But so that's something that's probably not appreciated. It's appreciated, but it's not understood until you actually put the watch on your wrist, I suppose. But something that I think is underappreciated, is more due to lack of understanding or education, is the movement construction and even down to timing in movements.
Yeah.
Like, and that is just down to lack of understanding, I suppose. We, you know, collectors can't be expected to understand what goes into timing a watch and stuff like that. But people don't really care that much these days about the accuracy of a watch. It's all about the dial. It's all about the case. It's the look of the watch. But there's a lot that goes on inside the watch just to get a watch to keep good time in certain positions and at half wind and full wind. And that's something that is, you know, I could spend hours on a hairspring and the customer will get it, put it on their wrist, and be just like, oh, this looks cool. And they might wear it 2 days a week and not even get to test the timing. So it's something that is definitely, it almost feels like a waste of time sometimes. Like, I think companies, Michael.
Yeah, I can just imagine you slaving away going, this fucking hairspring, why the fuck won't it get accurate? What the fuck is wrong with this thing? And then you get it perfect after hours and days of slaving away, and the guy's like, oh yeah, I'll probably pop that one back in the safe for a while until I need to, you know.
So I'm doing a lot of the watchmaking, like real watchmaking work on this thing. But in the end, if it's a collectible watch, they're not owning it or wearing it for the timing at all.
Michael, yeah. I'm your Huckleberry.
What's that?
I'm your Huckleberry. At my AP, there's a reason I'm an ex-owner of the AP.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
And as much as I love that watch, I mean, I love that. The dial was amazing. I mean, that bracelet is unbelievable.
It's phenomenal. Yeah.
Every time I'm like, it's 2 minutes late.
Right.
What the fuck's going on? I reset it another few weeks. It's still slow. What the heck? And eventually I'm like, gone. It was like that annoying. So I'm your Huckleberry. I get it.
I'm glad people do appreciate it. But I'm sure there's some companies out there, I'm sure they're actually getting together and saying, all right, we could save X amount of dollars if we didn't spend so many hours making sure this watch kept time perfectly. Like it costs a lot of time, because there's a lot of companies that still do a lot of manual dynamic poising to the balances. So they're removing metal at the last stage of the, you know, casing the watch up. They're removing metal from the balance in certain aspects or certain areas of the balance, just so it keeps time crown left compared to crown down and dial up. And, you know, there's so much time spent doing that. And I'm sure a lot of companies are sitting there with a conversation saying, I wonder if we should just skip this bit, you know, I wonder if we could get away with it.
I think the best line you had, Desi, for that RO, that Rolex, was great or fantastic watch, shit timekeeper. I think it was,
it was true. Yeah. It was true. Like, I loved it, but it was like, there's the but. I was like, oh my goodness. Just tell me the right time and I'll love you forever. Like, you know,
I haven't had that much experience with AP. I've serviced a couple of them and they've been okay, but I have heard people say that. So interesting.
So the next question begs, I mean, those pieces at that price, should there be an expectation those pieces be COSC certified out of the box?
Yeah.
At that price, you can't be spending all that money on a bracelet or a dial to have shit timekeeping and fork north of 15, 20, 25K without COSC certifying.
Exactly. Absolutely. Especially when there's a lot of ETA movements that are like COSC certified. Like, you know.
Especially when I've done 175 years of watchmaking, you think they must have been able to build one good one.
By now, they should have figured it out.
What was that, Dimmy?
They can't get shit right when it comes to timekeeping, those kind of companies.
Yeah, that's true. And the last one on this bit, there was a post the other day from Horror Mario Bro. I'm sure you guys know him. He put a picture up comparing the hands of a Krador Ichi 2 versus the Habring Chrono. And if you go onto his Instagram, you'll see it straight away. But I think underappreciated is the brands that spend the time that they put into the hands and the dial and the cleanliness and making sure that they're free of specs and blemishes and things like that. And I understand that a lot of these things you can only see under macro. But I think it talks to the care and attention to detail that brands put in it. And it's really cool to see here Habring that, you know, this watch, the Chrono, could sell anywhere between sort of 9 and say 12 grand Aussie for the split second versus the Credors that are, you know, God knows, 60, 70, 80 grand. And you'd expect a lot more from Credor given the amount of time and effort that goes into the polishing of Grand Seiko hands. But yeah, I think the hands are a super important part. They need to be right.
Nobody is safe. No brand is safe from Horror Mario Bro. He's looked at the hand stacks of Pateks and the undersides of minute, hour, seconds hands that have been unfinished. His Langer one had a wobbly seconds hand.
Well, even the movement finish on a Langer, I think.
Yeah, I guess someone was a bit too happy on the unglage and took a bit out of a certain section.
That really got through quality control. That was amazing. Yeah,
it was also good to see, Anthony, that we get a serve back to the watch regulator on the Habring washing machine.
Exactly. Finally finished washing machines, aren't they?
You want to have a suck that back up, Alex.
Love it. All right. Now, another guest and friend of the show, Scaramanga, has asked, do you leave your watch and socks on during sex?
I love this question. This is like, when I saw this is the highlight of the podcast, this question.
Oh, dear. All right. I'll just go first. So in winter, yes, that's all I'll say. Righto, who's next?
What else do you guys buy the chronographs? Hang on.
That was pretty quick. Was that like both watches and socks?
Yes. And in summer, just watches. Wow. In summer, just watches. I can't do the socks thing in summer because it's too hot.
Isn't taking the socks off called foreplay?
Possibly. Only if they were BAM socks. But anyway, that's another story.
Socks off, NATO off. It's all on. It's all happening.
See, that's why you need the NATO, because then the
we risk expands.
Seriously.
Maybe we just take the Vegas philosophy. What happens in the bedroom stays in the bedroom unless you're out in public.
And we'll leave
it at that.
All right, Michael, what's your take on this question? How can you answer
this? All right. I think no to both. You've got to take it all off. It's got to be there's got to be maximum amount of skin available. I think, and I was waiting for someone to say that they leave their socks on. Leaving your socks on during is just like, man, how hard is it to turn the electric blanket on beforehand? or just put a little bit more work into it and warm up that way, you know, like.
Yeah.
And I hope next time you're going for it, you can remember me saying this. No, but
I love it.
I think with the watch,
I'll be thinking of Woodsy. Hey.
Yeah, I think with the watch, if I was, I never do, but if I was, it'd have to be something like a Swatch Skin or a Cartier that just like sits low and it doesn't get in the way. Like, I can imagine.
What are you doing, my friend?
Like the worst one would be the IWC Big Pilot watch, because that, man, that onion crown
going to get stuck somewhere, is it?
What's that?
Is a big crown going to get stuck somewhere?
Yeah, that onion crown, there could actually be penetration. Like, if you've got more than one person, like if you're doing it Colex style, and there's like a like you never know that where that crown could end up, you know.
So you just need one of those G-Shock mud masters, don't you? That's
exactly.
Where it's at.
So I'm just that's my humble opinion.
waiting on Colex to drop a limited edition series of Big Pilots.
Exactly.
Does anyone else want to answer this question?
Well, I was just wondering if Scaramanga has, does dress ups, dress as a clown, or does, crazy sort of, would I keep my clown shoes on but take my socks off? Or, so I'm just wondering if he's looking for some sort of clarification on his, dress ups.
Who knows? What a cracker question, though. Thank you,
too good
for that one.
Too good.
Right, anyone else want to answer that? Nah, okay, we're good. We can move on.
I was expecting everyone to be like, this is the best question.
I'll answer. Yeah. I mean, you don't want to be looking at your watch, because you're just setting yourself up for disappointment. Put the watch on.
Certified, they won't have a problem there, Vinny.
Hey, maybe you could all wear silver Snoopies, because what is it about the 14 seconds? What could you achieve in 14 seconds? Effective time management. That's what
you'd have 13 seconds left over.
That's why you need the heartbreak mono pusher.
Just one time. Yeah, no use for the 10-minute countdown.
This is a mono pusher. Click. Here we go. Splits. That's why I need the split second chronograph. Split second, and we're done. There we go.
Oh dear.
You don't want something that's like super glowing in the dark either, because all you'll see is this glowing just like moving. Just
if you need to distract yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if the room's dark, they wouldn't light the way though, would you?
What's that? No, it'd just be this weird, like glowing
like
thing.
An eye watching you. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You could have a little minute repeater. Ding, 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 ding.
That would be something. I reckon, or
a vibrating alarm. Yeah, one of those JLC vibrating alarms.
Well, you've got the watches that are the sort of erotic watches.
Oh yeah, right.
Talking about underappreciated.
Yeah,
erotic watch complications.
That is.
Super. He's got something. Is it Breguet or Blanc? Is it Breguet? Isn't it?
Blancpain.
Blancpain.
Yeah.
That could be the watch to be wearing. Hi, darling. Look. Remind you of something. She's like, take your socks off. You got a shot. Oh, here we go.
Show the case back. This is what I want.
God.
That's like an old school way of like watching porn to get in the mood beforehand. Just like watch them going for it before.
I reckon, yeah, put your watch on your partner and there you go. Everyone's involved. Best of both worlds. Everyone's having fun.
Oh, God. All right, moving on. We have a unanimous punter here who's asked, who is the mysterious and sexy visionary behind the Fifth Wrist website? Does anyone know? Is he actually a real person?
Oh, I know the puppet, the watch regulator. Oh, but who's the puppet master?
Uh-huh.
That is the question.
There's someone behind him.
Yep.
Oh, dear. Or, anyway.
It's probably just alcohol.
Oh God! Anyway, Alex, that one was for you, so we'll see where that goes. All right, so that ends the questions from the community today, and we've got a heap more that we'll do in upcoming shows. So really looking forward to those, and thank you for the ones that sent them through. There's some more heated debates on, especially around the in-house, and some more questions. We can go a little bit deeper in some of this stuff. So thank you to the community for sending them through. And if anyone's got any topics, any listeners out there, just send them through to us. We're more than happy to bring them up or invite you onto the podcast to talk about them. So if there's something you're passionate about or want to explore, hit us up and we're more than happy to go for it. Cool. So the last little bit before we move into starting to wrap up with the Instagram follows, was the Philips Auctions put a post up this week on, well, this week or last week, I can't remember when it was, but it was about the Oyster Perpetual. So in their auctions, they have now a set of the five, I think they're the 41 mils, maybe the
36. No,
36
is 36.
And I suppose the comments in the post have been pretty full on.
Scathing as well.
And yeah, so I guess I just wanted to ask around the group, what are our thoughts on the fact that an auction house has got a hold of brand new watches, whether they came from Rolex or a Rolex AD or someone who managed to be able to be high up on a VIP list that was able to buy all five and then quickly auction them off. What are our opinions on this? We might start with Vinny. What do you think? Because I know you weren't too happy when you first saw this.
I have many thoughts for it, and I want to articulate them in a way that's constructive. I will go open with disappointing. To have a brand new watch and just straight to the auction market, it's almost as if they've gone, someone made the comment there, it's like, are you guys an auction house or a grey market dealer? Because that's pretty much what's happened. And just after this as well, I saw on Instagram, and I won't quote anything because I don't want anything to be incorrect or throwing someone on the bus or whatever it is. I don't want to get anyone in trouble. But it sort of brought out a lot of shady stories about how things may work in that side of the world where the auction's being held, and in other places in the world where how Rolex deals with clients and how clients deal with grey market dealers and how that all interacts. And it felt really dirty, and I don't want to be part of it. Of like, we love our watches, and you know, we really enjoy what the hobby brings us, and it just to see money hungry, money grabbing, it just felt dirty. And I don't know, it just felt like getting betrayed a bit, because we love these things for what they are and not for an investment vehicle. And yeah, it's just a whole roller coaster of disappointed, angry, upset. But then again, when there's a financial incentive to do anything, this kind of shit will happen. So yeah, it just sucks. Like, imagine the guy that's like, fuck, I would really love to get an Oyster Perpetual in whatever color. And they go to their local AD and they put their name down and they're like, yay, one day I'm going to get this call. It's going to be amazing. Only for this to happen. It just really disappointing from the collector's point of view.
It's five less watches out on the market for people who work hard to try and gain, whether it could be a grail or just another piece of their collection. It's five less watches now that's out in the open that can be bought.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's just rubbish.
It takes away, it goes back to how, I guess, concerning the waitlist thing is, and this just took it one step further. Just when I thought things couldn't get any crazier in the Rolex situation, this happened. And who knows who's responsible for this auction and how these watches have ended up at Philips. But it just...
It shouldn't matter how it ended up, because they either got given to Philips or Philips got priority consideration to say, you know what, well, yeah, just take whatever you want. And they said, we'll take these, we'll auction them off. Does anyone know what they went for?
It's not happened yet, but that was going to be my next question. What do we think is going to happen with them? And if someone buys all five, like, is that a, I don't know, maybe $60,000 or $70,000 process that not doubles but nearly doubles each individual price? I don't know.
It's scary.
What's recommended on these?
I think it's now about 83 Aussie. Could be wrong. Don't quote me. But it's around that for the OP36.
Okay.
So yeah, look, I think they're going to go for somewhere between 10 and 15 grand each, and it's just stupid. Like, I think for so many people out there that want to buy these watches, and then we see stuff like this happen, there's so many issues at the moment, and it's making so many people angry. And that's what I don't understand, is why would we want to make so many people angry? And I'll never forget being in Stuttgart and seeing this, going to all the ADs, having absolutely nothing, like no Milgauss, no nothing other than 31 mil diamond Datejust, and then seeing this cabinet that was about 5 meters long, about a meter deep, and there was two rows, and there was four Hulks, there was six Daytonas of each color, ceramic, there were four Batmans, like just everything in this one secondhand dealer. And it's just like, well, how does this make sense? It just doesn't. And it was just really frustrating.
Michael, I want to ask you, Michael, because you've worked for Rolex for an extended period of time at a high level. How do you feel about this?
Yeah, I don't like it, and I don't know much about it. I don't know what the incentive is and how they got them and who gave them, but I can understand that if it works right, then it works in Rolex's favour. As much as we don't like it, I think if these end up going for a premium, all of a sudden, you know, you've got another. You don't just have the Rolex sports watches desirable. They could be creating a higher desirability for another range of their watches, and that could be the motivation. I'm not 100% sure. I don't like it, and I think it's a bit ugly. I don't know what to say, to be honest. I thought Philips was the type of auction house that would be just, we deal in just vintage, and or you know, if it's pre-owned, then it's, you know, this is like straight from the AD or straight from Rolex. I don't know where it came
from. That's the worst case scenario, I thought in my head. Yeah. Like, all right, what's the worst thing that could possibly have happened here? Rolex has gone straight to the auction house and said, hey, throw these up. You'll get your auction fee and we'll get this market going and see and replicate what's happening across our sports model. Best case scenario, one collector's got greedy, who's like obviously a VVIP, can get access. He's gone, yoink. Phillips knows him very well and says, hey, how about let's do this thing?
Yep.
And let's see how much money you can make.
You're right. That would be the best case scenario. Like that would be the one where, all right, I don't know if that could have happened, but maybe. Maybe someone was lucky enough to get all of them. I'm not sure, but I suppose there's people that can then pull strings around the world and get that sort of thing. But look, it's on one side, I think it's quite clever if it works out. On the other side, I just think it's if I'm a person that wants one of these watches, I think it's ugly. Either way, I don't know who to blame, but I just think it's not nice. I think as you guys said, it's less watches for people out there. Yeah. Not that many watches is going to make a difference, but just the whole aspect that it's out there in the open that these new watches are just going straight to the secondhand market, sort of, and there's money being made by a legitimate auction house.
We wouldn't be talking about this if that were the Stage 2 brands, for example, or...
Yeah.
No. You know,
we wouldn't be talking about it.
No, exactly. So. It's really interesting. Like, I can see why they would be trying to do it, but I don't... Yeah, I didn't think it would happen. Not in a million years.
It'd be so good if someone bought them that was pissed off about it and then published photos of the warranty cards. Just to see, you know, just to see which AD has stamped it or, you know, because there has to be something on there. Yes, there doesn't need to be a name, but there needs to be a date of sale and there needs to be an AD stamp from where it was bought.
And they can go back to the serial numbers as well.
Yeah, but I'm sure Rolex can do that already. You know, if they want to track, you know, so there's a question, Michael, you're right, is business, and it could be a smart business. If it's meant to be, then it could be a smart business move, could backfire. If it's not intended, then obviously, I mean, there's nothing to, I mean, the richest, or you know, one of the richest organizations in the world, there's Rolex, they could easily just outbid anyone and get those and say, yep, here's the original, here's the serial numbers, here's the original owner, and just do the tracing. What it probably has done is it's probably damaged, especially from the collector community, the both reputation of Philips and Rolex, which is probably not what either really want.
Imagine if Rolex was the phone bidder.
Yeah, I just thought about that. Can you imagine if they just like went some stupid number and just said 30,000 a piece or something like just something ridiculous?
Yeah, but they might want to buy them back to find out who did it.
Well, maybe.
Because it's brand reputation.
Maybe, exactly.
Or they put them up to buy them back.
Yeah. Or wouldn't it be, I mean, I'm not wishing this on, like, I respect Rolex. I'm still close to Rolex. But I think we're almost all wishing or hoping that they just tank and they just don't even get retail somehow. Like, that would be the ultimate.
That would be good.
Yeah. Retail plus auction fees. Like,
yeah, exactly.
They'd just be like, yeah, look, you've...
Yeah. because it's like, all right, we'll just go out and get these eventually. They're not like getting a Daytona or a GMT or a sub. So yeah.
2020,
you have a conspiracy.
Absolutely.
It is an interesting one, though. I wonder if the information will come out and if we find out what happens. Like, yeah. Anyway,
if it's bad, it'll get buried.
Yes.
You know, there's too much at stake for both organizations. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was a interesting conversation. So let's we'll start to move to wrap up now and have a look at people to go follow on Instagram.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, please do. Sorry, Des.
Because we're all sort of watch collectors. My question was really around, if you had to go back to when you were starting, what advice would you now give the young Derek, Anthony, Michael, Vinny, and Demi?
That is a great question.
I can go first, and because I've made a couple of mistakes over the years, and I was looking at a thread the other day, and it was just a comment on Instagram, and it was about some guy that was, I think he was saving up for an OP, but was it was a blue bay, the new 58 blue, and he couldn't get it, and he was sick of waiting, and he wanted to go buy something else, and I saw a comment in there that resonates really well with me, that is, don't settle. Just because you can't get something, don't buy something in replace of that watch. If you want to buy something to scratch an itch, buy something completely different, but don't, because I did that. I couldn't find the BLNR back in about 2014, 2015. And so I went and bought a Super Ocean Heritage Breitling Blue Bezel Blue Dial, which is a fantastic watch, great watch. But then I eventually found the Batman, ended up selling the Breitling, lost a fair bit of money on the sale, and regretted it. And I did the same thing with the JLC when I couldn't find the Reverso, and then I ended up finding it. So just this game of collecting is not a don't think here and now. Think long term, think about what you want, and stick to the plan. Watches do show up, and you will find it. And the best feeling you can get in the world is when a watch shows up that you've been saving for and you've got the cash there to instantly go and get it. It is so satisfying to be able to do that, because you didn't go back and buy another watch that was a gap stopper or a filler at that time. So that would be my advice to myself 4 or 5 years ago.
I'll get some help as well, Anthony. If I put $1,000 above your retail price, you'd be on R. You can probably cover the cost of your Breitling that you lost money on.
yeah, okay. I didn't do too bad in that space. but what if that watch wasn't that like right. that?
And, 100%.
You know, so yeah, it's just something that and I've not done it since. I hung out for the Habering, and sure enough it showed up, and interestingly enough, another one showed up not too long ago that lasted about 3 weeks on chrono. So they, I think that one was number 9. So they do come up for sale. You've just got to be, ready to be able to do it when they do come. And that can be hard, waiting 6 months, 12 months with cash in the bank and not the watch you want, and see things that pop up all the time, but don't do it. Just wait.
Yeah, I sort of agree. I'll second that. I'm a very impulsive person and I still am, but yeah, if I could go back and say, just hold out. You don't, you know, try and get the best price or the best example of that piece. It'll come around eventually. And I think I still battle with that to a certain extent. I think as far as the type of watches I'd buy have changed, but I think you've almost got to go through that journey. I don't think I could go back and say, skip all of those other watches you bought, because you're going to end up with a different taste. I think you've got to go through that journey. But I think the process in actually selecting something to buy, or for me, it's a little bit difficult because I am so impulsive. And when I see something I like, it's all about me liking it, and I just want it now. And so it's hard. It's a difficult one, but yeah, try and hold out and get something that's just right. Especially if it's vintage, obviously the best example. If it's new, then well, you try and just get it. But yeah,
Vinny, lessons learned.
To be honest, I feel like I don't have the collecting experience to say I can look back and give myself good advice, because even though I've been heavily into watches maybe 6 years now, that's not a lot compared to a lot of guys out there that have a wealth of knowledge. And I think I've done okay. I don't have any major regrets or major lessons learnt, because being around you guys and having a great community around in Melbourne and online, I've been able to avoid mistakes and big ticket items that a lot of people do learn. So, I mean, the way my collections started and the way it is now, like I wouldn't change it. So I'm pretty happy, and I think I've got so much more to learn. But recently, JP, he was saying, we had a podcast, Anthony, and you asked me, what's my next watch? And I said, oh, probably a Reverso, because I really do love the Reverso. And then JP messaged me. He's like, hey, man, I thought, what about that Traditionnel VC? And I kind of given up on it for a while, because I just thought, oh, that's a large sum of money. Like, I'm never going to get there. I'll just see how things go. And if something I really love pops up, I'll work towards that. And then I thought, hang on. No, like, that's my ultimate watch. Why would I not work towards my ultimate favorite Grail watch? And it kind of pulled me in line a little bit, and that's where I'm headed. And I've been, really focused on it, and I'm not mucking around, doing my best to get there.
Yeah. It's a good, I think your biggest regret was giving Dane back that Traditionnel when
I didn't give it back. He had to, like, tie me up and pin me down and get law enforcement to pry it out of me. Yeah, that was not an easy one to give up.
How many NATO straps did he use to tie you down, Vinny?
And did he leave his socks on?
Nah, it's purely consensual, that part of it. That's why.
Oh, Dean's a lovely guy. He's a lovely guy.
Yeah, champion. It's part of the watchful experience. It's all good.
All right, let's go to, what about Dimmy? What's any advice that you would give yourself? And then we'll go to Desi.
I think we've all been through part of this anyway, but I think all the new guys are sort of starting out in a, we call it a hobby or an addiction or whatever it is. It actually becomes an addiction. I think the most important thing is to buy your watch dream that is going to satisfy you and your wrist, to make sure that you're happy with what you've bought and what you're wearing, as opposed to buying something that you think people are going to look at you and you're assuming you're going to be happy trying to please everybody else. You please yourself, make sure that the watch you bought, you're enjoying it, and just fuck everybody else, because no one else matters. No one else's perception of what you wear on your wrist matters.
Yeah, very true.
It doesn't matter.
Yep. You're the one that's going to be looking at it most of the time anyway. So,
yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. No, I think that's more important than ever, actually, Dimmy, because there's a lot of that going on. Buying, getting the latest and greatest just to impress people you don't really know with a watch you don't really like. So that is fantastic advice.
But you know what's good about that, though, is there's a lot of posts. I mean, people put up these posts on watch forums on Facebook and stuff saying, hey, I'm looking for this watch. Do you think it's a good investment? And it's been really cool to actually watch the comments and people not getting snotty about it, but writing things like, if you like it, buy it. And there's more often than not, there's more comments saying that than there are just saying watches are not an investment and giving the guy a bit of a hammer. So I think that's good. I think there's a real shift there where people are sort of saying, don't buy it. Don't buy a Rainbow Daytona because they're now $500,000. Buy it because you love it. And you want to pay 5 times retail, because that's cool.
Is that what they are?
Yeah, 500K in front of at the moment.
God,
bonkers.
Is it an actual photo, or is it just like a blank one?
That's okay? They're mainly they're just the stock press photos.
Yeah, so they're putting the price up, and then someone will go, "Ooh, I'll buy it," and then they'll go find one.
Thanks for telling me, Anthony, because I've got 6 here in my safe. Beautiful.
Just let those go and get your Roger Smith, Desi. No need for Santa.
One for Anthony, one for Michael, one for Benny. Yeah,
thank you.
Sign us up.
Cool, good stuff. And Desi, what about you? Advice?
I think similar to what there's two things I think I'd give myself. One is buy what you like and not what you think other people like. You know, you do get sucked into, you know, this is good and what can would this be? And I think that's part of the journey, which sort of Michael says, you kind of always go, everyone goes through. And I think also what this is really good is the community. So you get yourself into a watch community, get yourself into whatever is local. And that way you do get to taste other people's, you know, or get to see other people's sort of tastes and get to experience other watches without having to go and pony up. and help develop your palette essentially on the watch side. So, you know, what the community here does is fantastic, because we do get to experience other people's watches, and it's a, you know, you can almost walk around for 2 or 3 hours with someone's watch on your wrist and no one cares. And you get to experience that watch and say, actually, I like this style, this type of watch, this brand, this. So that community piece, of, I probably should have joined much earlier in my. And I think people are nervous, because you're nervous of your education, what you know about watches, your level of expertise. But it's actually the best thing to do is jump into the community, and that accelerates your knowledge and embracement, you know, and you get embraced by the community to kind of help you.
It's great advice.
Yeah. Yep.
Very great advice. The only last thing I'd say is I look back now and I kind of wish that I had a website like Fifth Wrist to go visit when I was just sort of learning out about watches, because let's face it, you know, Fifth Wrist is exactly about this kind of stuff, that, you know, being able to connect with people, become part of a community, you know, read people's reviews that they've actually owned the watch. You know, so I think having something like Fifth Wrist available to the community to go on and read and research, and then reach out to that person and ask a question you might have or whatever. And I've found that people in the watch community are just so welcoming and forthcoming to offer up their point of view or advice or, you know, whatever it might be. And yeah, I'm just so happy that the community is just continuing to grow. And I've really enjoyed seeing people come in that are so fresh and early into it. The amount they learn so quickly just from being connected to the community is just awesome. So
that's so true. Yeah. Like years ago, it would take a lot longer to experience all of the watches and the opinions. And these days, you know, people involved in the Slack chat even, and just looking at Fifth Wrist, yeah, the reviews. I mean, yeah, you get to progress through your journey a lot quicker, I think, younger collectors these days. So I think it's fantastic.
It's also without prejudice. Like if you know, someone could love Rolex, but if they truly love Rolex and they're really into it, and there's like, great, everyone learns something and you see an appreciation and you see their joy, you're like, that's fantastic. You know, and if someone's an independent or love their Speedmasters and can, you know, all the different views, there's no prejudice. You absorb that as well. You're like, oh, that's part of my learning. So that seems to be a unique aspect as well, which is, you know, very different to, you know, I drive this. You know, like if you think about cars, there's, you know, you're a Holden fan or a Ford fan or, you know, you have a bias. Here, there seems to be less of that, or almost non-existent.
Great question, Desi. Great question.
Thank you.
All right, cool. Let's move to wrap up now and people to go follow on Instagram and we will finish up. So why don't we go with our guests first? We'll go with Desi and then Dimmy and then the rest of us nutcases to follow.
Well,
so Desi.
Desi, thank you. It gets hard because when I look at my Instagram feed, I'm like, was this from Fifth Wrist where I just followed all the recommendations or is this one I've stumbled on myself? So hopefully I stumbled on this one myself. Edinburgh Timepieces, all one word. Some fantastic shots. It's got a whole bunch of different, really I mean, it gets his lighting spot on, but he's got F.P. Jorn, he's got a bunch of, he's got Omega, he's got a bunch of different watches. So really cool. Just visually, I think just spectacular. So
very nice photographs. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. I enjoy that feed.
Yep.
Very good. Jimmy, what about you?
I guess over the past few months, I've had this guy's probably been tagging me in a fair bit of his shots. And I guess my sort of photos for a while have been going down the lifestyle watch photography path. And there's a guy named Jack who goes by the handle of wrist_wiss. And his lifestyle photography that he's come up with is just amazing. Just the mood and the vibe about everything he posts is kind of gets me hooked to all his posts these days, which is really good.
So
wrist_wiss. Guy named Jack.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good one. What about Michael? Let's go with you.
Yep. I'll pick one that almost purely because I just connected with her like today. And I looked and I saw that none of you guys, I think, are following us. So
cool.
It's watch.gringa.
Watch.gringa.
Yep. And yeah, she's, there's a tutor there. There's an Omega Speedmaster, there's a few nice watches, and yeah, just a Cartier and a few cool picks. But yeah, she seems like a cool chick. So.
Well, I wonder what she's going to think of this podcast about three quarters of the way through, if she's going to listen.
We'll see. She'll love it.
Yeah, we'll see.
I am following now.
Well, geez, she follows me, but I follow her back.
Oh, right, okay.
There you go. Back, Insta-famous.
And shout out, because they're a husband and wife team. That's pretty
cool. Yes, I saw that. Yeah. That's right.
Yep.
So I think they're sharing a lot of their watches, but that's cool. Yeah, it's good. It's good, especially if you can find a partner that shares the passion like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
It's going to be expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. The watches are half price because you just pay half each.
But at least the other person understands, you know.
That's true. Yeah. Vinny, what about yours?
Alrighty, so I've gone. This one is called Maxtor 71. So MAXTOR 71. Just incredible photography.
Wow! Like
just insane. Like the one I'm looking at now is a Meteorite Subdial, and you see every little abrasive nook and cranny of that subdial. It's insane level of photography. So that's
I love to know what macro lens uses there.
Good one.
I was already following.
Yeah, that is incredible photography.
What a guy.
Yeah, I just like, I only saw this recently. I thought, wow, the next level.
Sure.
So
follow it. It's done.
Thank you.
Next.
And so mine is the 349 Designer. So check this guy out. He's a Italian guy who he designs and gets built his own one-off watches. And he's got some really cool dial case and handset on his latest project. And I'm really pleased to say that I'm recording a podcast with him to talk about his journey building his own one-off watches. He's done a couple. And what it's like and who he dealt with and what he did and how he came up with things. So I'm really looking forward to that discussion with him, because I think there's so much to say. Everyone talks about this stuff. He's gone and done it. So really, really impressive to see. And I actually really, I was spewing when I looked in a bit deeper and found that I couldn't actually buy this watch, because those hands are so unique. The case shape is unique. The stepped bezel is unique. Yeah, just a really, really cool. So that's he's called it the 349 Sport.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, give him a follow, because he needs to grow his profile, because there's not many people out there that can do that. So very cool. Cool bananas. Well, thank you to our first special guest, Desi. Thank you for coming on the show today. It's a real pleasure and something that I've wanted to do for a long time. And thanks for that awesome story about you getting busted.
I'm glad you can rejoice in my pain. Wonderful.
That's the whole idea. And over to our mystery guest, Dimmy. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure to have you back on the show again.
Awesome, awesome speaking with you all as well.
Vote for Sarpaneva watch on the
yes. All right, guys. So lastly, before we wrap up, we'll just have a quick chat. So remember that if you want to enter or come and join us in our community on the Slack group, just email myself, anthony@fifthwrist.com, or get in touch with Alex or any one of the people on this podcast. We'll be able to point you in the right direction. But we've got some really cool threads going. We've got podcast chat. We've got projects. We've got watches. We've got website. We've got off topic. So there's something for everyone to enjoy. Head over to the website. Please review 1, 2, 3, 4 of your watches. We really want to hear. And we're starting to grow the double ups as well, and seeing the different things that people feel about watches. And that's what it's all about, sharing the knowledge that you have. I think we are done, gentlemen. Thank you all so much. Have a fantastic rest of the weekend. And to everyone else, stay on time.